from the Gentile institution.
After having had the Great Prayer Festival, we are now attending the main public teaching, which I couldn't have last year because of my illness. I see a big number of people coming from different areas, from different places. The text that we are going to study this time is the Bodhicharya Avatara and maintaining like the rays of the sun. Bodhicharya Avatara, which is composed by Shantideva, right from the time he composed this text. This text has been treated as the most supreme text with regard to transforming the mind, and since from the time this text has been translated into Tibetan, this has been treated as one of the main text for transforming the mind, and this is a text which has been studied by all the four Tibetan Buddhist schools of thought. And the second text, Mind Training Like the Rays of the Sun, is a commentary on the 7 points of mind training. The 7 points on mind training is a text that comes from the Master Chekhova, which focuses primarily on the practice of exchanging oneself. For the others, and since then many of the followers take down several notes and then come up with this root text called 7 points on mind training. And there are various versions of my 7 points on mind training, which cite different usage of words and so on. But the lineage primarily came to the Kadamba master Chekhova. I have received the commentary of the Bodhicharya Avatara from the late master Lama Tenzin Gyaltsen in the very holy place, Bodh Gaya. First of all, I received the teaching on the text called Praising the Bodhicitta, and then I received the commentary of the Bodhicharya Avatara, and in fact I received most of the texts on mind training and Bodhicitta practice from him. And with regard to the second text, Mind Training Like the Rays of the Sun, I received the commentary from my senior tutor, Ling Rinpoche. And today, among the audience who have gathered here to listen to this commentary, we have here the presence of the reincarnation of Khundun Lama Tenzin Gyaltsen, and I am very happy and feel privileged. And similarly, the reincarnation of Ling Rinpoche, who is undertaking serious study in the monasteries, he is also here, and I'm very happy. And apart from that, I have nothing very special to say. And what all I want to say is that we have gathered here for a few days for undertaking Dharma practice. The Tibetan word for Dharma is chu, which means to change and to transform. Changing here is changing one's own mental attitude, one's way of thinking. And as a result of changing of one's own mind, the way you speak to others should be changed. The way you express physically and behave yourself to others will be transformed. Now the question is, how such transformation takes place? Now in the case of physical behavior, there are certain aggressive activities like stealing from others, harming others' body, engaging in sexual misconduct. These physical actions which directly harms others, this must be stopped and change the transport. So in this way, your ordinary, harsh, aggressive physical behavior should be transformed into something that is peaceful, something that is beneficial and helpful to others. And verbally, if you are in the habit of telling lies, deceiving others, speaking harsh words or bad words, and not only in terms of making a joke, but when you seriously intend to cow down others or discourage others with that kind of motivation, when you speak harsh words, then this kind of verbal actions should also be changed, so that gradually your words will become soft, pleasant, compassionate, honest, straightforward, so that everybody would like to listen to what you say. And on the other hand, right from the beginning when you start a discussion, if you bring up all the shortcomings and faults and problems and complaints, then this kind of undisciplined state of the mind brings problem in the mind of everybody. That's why we see sometimes some people, right from the beginning when they start saying something, everybody wants to distance from that person and go away from that person. So instead of that, we should try to speak in a way which is meaningful, which is kind, which is soothing. So these are the things that human beings can perform in an effective way, comparing to animals and so on. So this kind of verbal change is called verbal religious practice. And similarly, you should also use, recite certain mantras, and most importantly, remember and memorize certain meaningful, profound scriptures. And in this way, you can make your human speech meaningful. That is how you can transform your speech. And now such kind of transformation of physical activities and verbal speeches, this should not be done as is being asked by others or being forced by others. Because if it is being forced by others,
for example, under an oppressive rule, you are told not to say this here or there and so forth, but somehow you find an opportunity to engage in the same kind of behavior and the speech.
So the real transformation and change of the speech and the physical actions must be brought about with a strong inclination mentally and without being forced to others, through your own willpower, by understanding and seeing the long-term benefits of such transformed states of body and speech. With that kind of realization, if you bring about those changes, then it will be beneficial to oneself and to others. And at least you should lead a life which will not create unhappiness and inconveniences in the minds of others. And if you are able to spend your life with good kind words, verbally and physically, then that is how you can make your life meaningful. To sum up the point, however long we might live, maximum length of your life may be 100 years old, and during those 100 years, there is no other place to live except among human friends, human beings. This being the case, if you go about and creating enemies and conflicts all around, then you will make this short life very disturbing, very unhappy. So you should not lead a life as if you are born in this world to bring more turbulence and more problem. And the fact is that since we are dependent on the kindness and the companion of others, so therefore even if you are unable to help others, do not harm them, do not bring conflict, do not bring turbulence, do not lead a life which is source of destruction for oneself and for other people. If you do so, not only you will create a lot of suffering for others, you yourself will suffer. For example, if you keep on speaking harsh words, harmful words to others, and physically if you deceive others, and cast negative kind of expressions, then wherever you look, whether you look at the right or the left, you will find nobody to whom you can trust. You will have no friends. And so because of your own behavior, you can't find anybody to trust or to entrust. And it is primarily because of your own negative behavior. If you lead such a negative behavior, then naturally you will earn such a result from other people, because you can't expect everybody as bodhisattvas. They are also ordinary unenlightened beings, and they will react accordingly. Now, on the other hand, if you genuinely practice loving kindness and genuinely practice compassion, and thereby try to help others as much as possible, and at least do not harm them, and thereby lead a tranquil physical state of physical state and also verbal state, and then because of having led such a virtuous state of life, because of not having disturbed others, because of not having harmed others, and because of trying your best to help others and not to harm others, then irrespective of whether you treat or categorize those activities as religious or not, but in reality you are practicing dharma, you are practicing religion. And in fact, the demarcation between what is virtuous and what is non-virtuous is, virtuous actions are those actions which directly or indirectly help others, and non-virtuous actions are those that harms others, that disturbs others, those that bring unhappiness in the minds of others. And it is by leading such a negative way of life that you will suffer in this life and bring about long-term negative consequences for many lives to come. So therefore, when we talk about undertaking spiritual or dharma practice, what we should try to do is to transform one's mind, body, and speech. And transforming one's body, mind, and speech primarily means to lead a way of life which will help others, which will benefit others. And if you make such an effort for transforming your body, speech, and mind, then right in the beginning, of course, you might face some problems because you are used with certain negative habits, way of life. For example, you might get tempted to kill the insects or beat the dogs or animals and so on, but gradually with your sustained effort you will pick up those result of getting habituated with those virtuous practices. Later on you will be able to practice them continuously without having to need much effort. And even in the case of animals, if they are habituated with certain ways of life, then they do it automatically without having to make much effort. Now in our case, in the case of afflictive emotions, we are so habituated with that, because of this, even with the slightest... There is a monkey who has also come to attend the teaching, and he is actually watching the monks, whether the monks are sleeping or yawning. So you may be in the beginning someone who gets easily provoked by slightest usage of words and slightest behavior, negative behavior. But once you get habituated with those virtuous practices, you will not find it difficult to tolerate those disturbances. And even in the case of more profound practices like development of bodhicitta and view of emptiness, even these practices will become easy. So what is really important is right from the beginning you should develop this wish to bring about actual transformation and change within one's mind, so that gradually, without being asked by others, you can voluntarily and with strong sense of appreciation enter into such spiritual practice with great joy and happiness and appreciation. So therefore, when we talk about Dharma practice or spiritual practice, it is changing the negative ways of life into positive ways of life, whether it is in terms of your speech, in terms of your physical behavior, or in terms of your way of thinking. And without such transformation, it will not become a genuine practice. Now, for example, you may be someone who normally does a lot of circumambulation around the temple, does a lot of recitations of mantras, but while superficially undertaking all those spiritual practices, you may be still a person who will not be able to tolerate even slight different usage of words. You get easily provoked and get angry. This clearly shows your practice is not hitting the target. And now, out of the three, the physical, verbal and mental actions, the most important is the mental action. Now, for example, negative physical actions or verbal actions, these are also, of course, bad. But the source of them is the mental action. Because the physical and verbal actions, they have limitations. Their effect is very limited. We can take a very ordinary example. Take the example of someone who is practicing long jump. Now, he or she can, by practicing, can improve the long jump, but it cannot be reached to a limitless stage where you can jump from one mountain to another mountain. So clearly showing that there is a limitation with physical progress and development, and likewise verbal actions. But in the case of the mind, there is no such limitation. It can be very destructive. And for example, we can mentally think about either helping the whole sentient beings of the whole world, or we can think about bringing about total destruction within all the sentient beings. So we can clearly see that the power of the qualities that are dependent on the mind can be developed to a limitless state, and by developing and practicing motivation which thinks and cares about benefiting countless living beings, it is through such practice that you achieve enlightenment. And in the case of physical and verbal actions, they have limitation, whereas in the case of the mental qualities, it can be developed to limitless quality. And particularly when we talk about those qualities which are dependent not on the grosser levels of the mind, but on the subtler levels of the mind, because the subtle level of the mind goes from one life to another life, therefore the qualities that are developed in relation to subtle mind can also be transmitted from one life to another life, and therefore such qualities can be developed to a limitless quality. And therefore it is important to undertake spiritual practice primarily through your mind rather than body and speech. And that is why in the various religious traditions that we see in the world, that there are some religious practices. Now, for example, if you look at the Indian religious systems, you will find there are certain systems like the Brahmanical practice, where the focus of religious practice is more on meditation on sound, like reflecting on the sound of the Om. And then there are other practices where one undertakes a lot of physical hardships. And whereas in the case of Buddhist practice, the religious practice should be done by the mind, and that is what is being outlined in the Aryadeva text called 400 verses. Once your mind is disciplined and transformed, naturally your words and your physical actions will also be transformed and disciplined. And when your mind is transformed, then even if physical and verbal actions are not transformed, you can gradually transform them because of your mental state of change state of your mind. And if you do not bring about real change within the mind, then even if you speak politely and try to behave physically very nicely, this will become a kind of practice in publicity. It will become almost like deceiving others. And therefore it is important to follow those techniques by which we can bring about changes within the mind. And here it is important to know how such negative emotions like attachment, hatred, anger, how this disturbs one's own mind, how this negative emotions harms others. And that is why in Buddhism, constantly what is being taught is the destructive effect of attachment, hatred, anger, and so on, and likewise the constructive results of loving kindness, compassion, and so on. In fact, with respect to such practices, most of the religious traditions of the world, which possess a different philosophy, they all agree upon that. But however, in the case of other religious traditions of the world, they undertake such a practice by primarily showing faith and devotion to the teaching of one's own teacher. It is primarily because of one's devotion, faith, and respect to the teacher that you undertake those practices. Whereas in the case of Buddhist practice, one undertakes such practices not because it has been simply taught by Buddha, but because it is beneficial to oneself and beneficial to others. And that is why in Buddhism we do not believe in a creator God, and we also do not accept that things arise without depending on causes and conditions. And we believe that things arise by depending on their preceding causes and conditions, causes and factors. So things are interrelated, and out of multiplicity of causes and factors, and particularly when we talk about the experiences of living sentient beings. Sentient beings here all primarily mean those living beings that possess a mind. In the case of experiences of such a sentient being, all the sufferings arise primarily due to negative emotions, which are the causes and factors for such experiences. And contrarily, if your mind is disciplined and transformed, then that will produce healthy results. And as a result, we experience peace and happiness. And in the case of inanimate objects or in the case of sentient beings, both are same. In the case of experiencing changes depending upon their causes and factors, but in the case of sentient beings, when we talk about experience of happiness and suffering, they are very much dependent on their causes and factors. So if your mind is disciplined, then you commit positive deeds. As a result, you experience good results, happiness. And when you perform negative actions, then you experience suffering as a result. Now when we talk about happiness and peace as a result, happiness and peace is something that we all want, we all desire, and that's why we say it is good. And all those actions that lead to such peace and happiness, we recognize them as good. And therefore those causes, those actions which bring about such peace and happiness is identified as virtuous, as constructive, as positive. And whereas in the case of negative actions are called negative actions because they produce results which bring us fear within our mind, which bring suffering. And in the case of those categories of phenomena which brings neither peace and happiness nor suffering and problem, they are called neutral results, which are produced by neutral actions, neutral causes and factors. So here in the case of Buddhism, when we undertake chastity practices for removing happiness, for removing the causes for suffering and for cultivating causes for peace and happiness, we are undertaking such practices not because it has been simply taught by Buddha, but because of the fact that by nature we want happiness and do not want suffering. And this being the case, we need to take care of the causes that produces happiness and to remove those causes and conditions which bring about suffering. Now therefore, with regard to the transformation of the mind, we need to undertake a detailed understanding and recognition of what are the causes and factors that are responsible for bringing about certain happiness and peace, and what are the causes and factors that are responsible for suffering. And so this process of cultivating positive habits in the mind and removing negative habits in the mind should be done exactly how we do with the external material development. When we make some external material development, then what we do is to identify those constructive factors, and for example in the case of plants, those plants which we want, we identify their causes and plant them and nurture them. In the case of those plants like a poisonous tree, we do not want them, therefore we identify their causes and factors and then we try to remove them. Now, for example, in the case when you experience hatred, take a moment to take a moment and contemplate. How do you feel? What is your experience when you experience such anger and hatred? Does it give you peace or does it disturb your mind? And if it really disturbs your mind, makes you unhappiness, then you find out what are the causes, what are the factors that brings about such hatred, such anger. So that is the way to change and transform your mind. And even in the case of development of positive qualities, like for example strong devotion and faith. Now if you simply without much knowledge close your eyes, sit down and try to force yourself to develop some kind of faith and devotion to particular deity or particular teacher and so on, you might develop some kind of concentration and some kind of relief. But such kind of faith and devotion is not strong, not reliable. So your cultivation of faith and devotion must be based on knowledge, based on reason. Why should you develop such a faith, such a devotion to certain particular object? So therefore, when we talk about transforming the mind, it should be done by taking into consideration how the law of nature functions, what is the process. And that's why in Buddhism so much emphasis is made on developing wisdom, a fine sense of discrimination between what is right and what is wrong. And therefore, all of us who have gathered here, in the pursuit of transforming our mind, undertaking some spiritual practice, and we have not gathered here because we are offering a lavish banquet, and you are not here to watch a drama or a scene, and you did not come for anything else but in the pursuit of spiritual religious practice. So therefore it's really important to understand the process of undertaking the practice. And I also would like to tell you that if you look at the state of the major religious traditions of the world, you can find two aspects in each religious traditions. On the one hand, there is this religious aspect where there is much similarity with all the major religious traditions of the world, because the main message of all the religious traditions of the world is how to be kind, how to develop love, compassion, and so on. And of course, there are minor differences where some religious traditions pray to a sun or a nature or a moon and so on. But then on the other hand, in all of these religions, traditions, there is the philosophical aspect. Now if you compare the different philosophies of all these major religious traditions of the world, you will find there is a big difference. And such differences are found not only among the major religious traditions of the world, but even if you compare the ancient Indian, various ancient Indian thought, you will find wide varieties of philosophical presentations. Now what is the purpose of all these different philosophies which are in many cases so different? The purpose of all these philosophies is to teach love, to teach compassion. And, so this major, this main message which is being taught in all the major religious traditions is something which we can all easily agree. For example, when they teach about do not kill, do not rape, or do not lie, and so on. If you are able to tell lie very cleverly, then probably may be acceptable to some extent. But generally, it's not good. And unfortunately, these days, if you are very clever in telling the lie, people accept that person. And similarly, if you are overly clever, again, people accept it, which is unfortunate. But what I'm trying to say is that all the major religious traditions of the world saying is that all those human bad human behaviors which brings disturbance, which are normally recognized as harmful and bad, these are discouraged by all the major religious traditions of the world. And all those good behaviors, now for example, right from the birth, we all appreciate love, we all appreciate kindness. Look at the milk of the mother. We are all nourished in the case of the those who are born from the womb. And we are all nourished by mother's womb, or mother's milk. And now even in the case of animals, the babies depend on the milk of the mother, and so the milk, I would say, is the symbol of love, symbol of kindness. The very structure of our physical makeup, the very biological structure is such that we survive and we nourish through love and compassion. The mother is dependent on the child, and the child is dependent on the mother, and without depending on the mother, the child cannot survive. So therefore there is this mutual love between the mother and the child. And I was therefore curious in the case of some other species of alien beings, like a butterfly. They lay the egg and then they fly away. Probably the mother and the child, they will never see each other. And similar is the case with the tortoise. The tortoise lays their egg and then they go away. So I was wondering that later on, if you bring this child closer to the mother tortoise or the butterfly, what will be their reaction? I don't think they will have any love and affection to each other. Biologically, they are not dependent on each other. Whereas in the case of human beings, biologically, we need such love, such compassion. That is there. And the very fact why we need love is we are dependent on others. So if you are devoid of love, then you are not fully qualified human being, I would say. And particularly this is true in the case when we are young. And unfortunately, when we grow up and we become adult and young and energetic, and then sometimes you forget that love and you feel I am completely independent, I can manage myself, but still you are under an illusion. Because however efficient and capable, rich and you may be, how will you survive? For example, in the case of the Tibetans, for example, you need rice, you need grain. Now in the case of Tibetans, we need samba. How will you get the samba? Someone has to fry the barley, someone has to grind it. And, so without depending on other people's labor
and similarly look at the clothes that you wear, as is said in the practice of mind training, whether it is your clothing, or it is food, or it is your name and fame, you are totally dependent on others, irrespective of the fact that others are thinking about benefiting you or not. But the reality is that you are dependent on others, and therefore all the problems that we faced in the past is because of lack of proper compassion, lack of loving kindness, and therefore it is important to realize that by nature we are dependent on others, and therefore we need love and compassion, and therefore such cultivation of love and compassion is in tune with the process of the nature. Now, anger is bad, hatred is bad, not because it is being taught by the Buddha, but hatred and anger is bad because by nature we are dependent on others. And if you are angry, if you get angry to that very person to whom you are dependent, if you develop hatred to that very sentient being to whom you are dependent, how can you have peace and happiness? So that is against the process of nature. So in all the major religious traditions of the world, love and kindness is very much encouraged, because by nature we all need such positive practices. And even in the case of Buddhism, when you go into the area of philosophy, then of course there are different presentations, and that's why we have Vaibhashika philosophies, and then philosophy of Southern Tika, Mindful School, Madhyamika, and so on. And among our Western friends, I'm sure there are many of you who belong to one of the other different major religious traditions in the world. And I always tell people that in terms of philosophies of the major religious traditions of the world, there may be big differences, but the message of all religion is to benefit others, to help others, to be kind to others, to develop love and compassion to others. So therefore it is extremely important to live harmoniously, and it is absolutely wrong, and it is outdated to say that my religion is best, therefore all of you should follow my religion. And what is important is you should undertake a practice or embrace a religion which is suitable to you. This is exactly the same way we taste different foods. Some people prefer food which is sour, some people prefer food which is so hot. And if you say that because I like hot food, everybody should eat hot food, then that is stupid. And similarly, there could be someone who is very fond of thick butter tea, and because of your liking thick butter tea, and if you ask everybody to take that butter tea, then that is absolutely wrong. And this reminded me a joke, and once I encouraged the monk in the monastery not to drink very thick butter tea because it's not good for their health, and I also told them that this will, you know, produce cough and so on. And then later on I heard that when someone starts coughing, then the other fellow tells him, "Don't cough, otherwise you will get very thirsty." And in my case, I have been sincerely trying to practice that, and trying to develop respect to every other follower, every other religious tradition. And I have so if you change your religion, you must do so properly thinking and reflecting carefully. And I in fact remember one Christian friend who later on became a Buddhist, and then at the time of death he was feeling slightly uneasy. I could see some kind of disturbances. Probably at that time he must be thinking, now there is no creator God to whom I should rely, he may be reflecting something like that.
So,
So I found that friend at the time of death, he was a little bit confused. He was not angry, but he was a little bit confused where to rely. So it is important to use your own wisdom and through your own experience, through your own wisdom, and if you are sure that a particular religious tradition is more suitable, then of course you have every right to follow it. But do not change your religion in haste. And of course, this is an introductory talk. And later on, when I actually explain the text, then I will follow the actual spirit of the Buddhist teaching, where occasionally topics will come out which will refute Creator God. So this is, at that time you should remember that this is primarily for the teaching for the Buddhists. And I'm not encouraging that everybody should become Buddhist. And then later on, in certain sections of the Bodhicaryavatara, there are sections where which discourages the life of a woman. And in fact, in the past also, I met some people who were saying that, who even started saying that, do not study Bodhicaryavatara because Bodhicaryavatara looks down upon the women. That is also a wrong understanding, because if you look to the origin of the teaching of Bodhicaryavatara, it was primarily taught to the monks, if it has been taught to only women, then there you might today find a lot of lines in Bodhicaryavatara which discourages life of a man. So the purpose is for the sanghas, for the men, in order to reduce certain desire attachment. It highlights the faults of women. And similarly, in the case of a woman meditator, it is important to meditate on the faults of man, so you should clearly understand such distinctions. So when I follow the main text, I will be strictly explaining in accordance with the spirit of the text. So here and there, if you get hurt, then you must understand it in its proper context. So anyway, the main thing that I was saying is dharma means to change your mind, to transform mind. Changing your mind cannot be done by just remaining stubborn without knowledge and understanding, but truly understanding and appreciating long-term benefits and problems. So I'll start the text, mind turning like the rays of the sun. Those of you who don't have this English version of the text, maintaining like the rays of the sun, this is the text, and probably you can buy it from the library. Library of Tibetan Works and Archives. You can buy it. Holiness is asking people who are sitting in the sun to get themselves protected from the heat, to put on caps or umbrellas or whatever. Homage to at all times, I take refuge in and prostrate at the feet of the sublime and infinitely compassionate spiritual masters. Out of their immense love, they care for me in every moment of my life. And then a prayer of devotion, arising from the source of love and compassion. The Shiva of the awakening mind is well launched. Above it, below the great sense of the six perfections and the four ways of amassing the disciples. which are driven by the wind of enthusiastic effort, can never slacken. Perfectly it carries embodied beings across the ocean of cyclic existence, landing them on the beach-fulfilling jewel island of omniscience. I prostrate, placing my head at the feet of the leaders of the spiritual lineage. The subduer, who is our supreme navigator, the powerful Buddha Shakyamuni, Maitreya and his spiritual followers, Asanga, Vasubandhu, and Vidya Kokila, Manjushri and his followers, Nagarjuna, and the supreme vice president, Deva, the ruler of the golden isle of Sumatra, and his disciple, the Lord Adisha, and his Tibetan disciple, Dongtenpa, and his three spiritual brothers, Potowa, Kuchongwa, and Tengawa. I prostrate at the feet of the great emanation of Manjushri. And then Tsongkhapa, the second conqueror of this degenerate times. Tsongkhapa in fact was the master of the composer of this text. From whom we received this teaching directly. And therefore Tsongkhapa is the second conqueror of this degenerate times. Who founded the individual spiritual paths of these great pioneers with extreme lucidity and coherence. The supreme among all these wonderful teachings are the means for activating the awakening mind. I shall expound his perfect teaching with absolute accuracy. Those fortunate to follow the way of the great art, they should pay those attention for true appreciation. Here, when we make this praise out of devotion to these great masters, the praises are done primarily in terms of their many qualities, like loving kindness, compassion, and so on. Loving kindness is the wish that transcendent beings meet with happiness, and compassion is the mind aspiring that all are without suffering. And the compassion is also not limited for a section of sentient beings, but it embraces the infinite, countless sentient beings, that they be free from not only suffering, but from the causes of suffering. And such an aspiration is limited not in terms of prayer, but it is induced by a strong sense of compassion, which is motivated by a strong sense of personal responsibility, which then leads to the development of bodhicitta. And that is why this line it says, supreme among all his wonderful teachings are the means of activating the awakening mind. So to go back to these verses of devotion, it says, arising from the source of love and compassion, which is holiness by explaining, the Shiva that which arises from love and compassion is the Shiva of the awakening mind, which is well launched. And above it, below the great cells of the six perfections and the four ways of MSR disciples. So these are the practices of the Bodhisattva, the six perfections, like practice of humility and so on, and the four ways of collecting the disciples. Now for such a ship which sails in the sea, it is not enough that it is the great sails, but such sails must be moved by the wind. And therefore, in the case of bodhicitta also, driven by the wind of effort, which never stops, which never slackens, then you can carry the sentient beings across the ocean of cyclic existence from samsara. And it is through repeated practice of such a development of bodhicitta, unslackened effort, that you can gradually land on the wish-fulfilling jewel island of omniscience and Buddhahood. So it is, the text is simply saying that it is by developing bodhicitta, undertaking the practices of six perfections and the four ways of gathering disciples, that you can enter enlightenment and that you can come out of the ocean of samsara, the cycle of existence. So here you can clearly see that the process of enlightened being that helps the sentient beings is showing a path which he himself has traversed, and it is through gradually passing through the 10 grounds and the 5 paths that you can reach the jewel island of Buddhahood or enlightenment. So therefore Buddha Shakyamuni is like a great merchant who is well acquainted with the paths that lead to the land of island. And this therefore has the similar meaning as is explained in the verse paying homage in the Nagarjuna's Fundamental Wisdom, where he says, I pay homage to the Gautama Buddha, one who is motivated by compassion, has discarded all wrong views, and thereby has given the sublime teaching. Now this verse by Nagarjuna means that the root cause of all suffering and problems is ignorance. Ignorance is not lack of knowledge, but misconception of reality, and such misconceptions of reality can be removed by developing correct insight into the view of emptiness, into reality, and therefore the misconception of reality, which is known as ignorance, is a kind of corrupted wisdom. And of course when we talk about ignorance, there could be so many varieties of ignorance, but the main ignorance there, the main ignorance which is the root cause of samsara, is as I said earlier, is a misconception of reality that wrongly perceives the way things are. So it is by dispelling such wrong view that the Buddha taught the Sauna teaching, and it is by showing such a path that he helps sentient beings to achieve enlightenment. And such misconception of reality, such ignorance can be removed, not simply sitting and praying, but it can be removed by developing a wisdom which is antidote to such ignorance and misconception of reality. Now how can we identify and recognize these two minds, one which is the right view and another is the wrong view? The wrong view is so called because things do not exist, and it is perceived by such a wrong view, whereas in the case of a correct view, correct wisdom, it perceives the reality as they are. Since these two minds are completely contradictory, they are mutually exclusive, and they cannot exist together at the same time. Therefore, if you strengthen the correct view, if you empower that correct view, the more you strengthen that correct view, the wisdom, this will help gradually decrease and weaken the negative mind, the wrong view, the negative emotions, and finally you can eliminate them. And again, it's important to know that in the case of wrong minds, like afflictive emotions, like attachment, hatred, and so on, however powerful they may be, but they cannot be developed to a limitless quality because they do not have a solid, reasonable foundation. Whereas in the case of virtuous state of mind, positive state of mind, like wisdom, understanding, emptiness, because they are based on reason, they are based on solid foundation, they can be developed to limitless quality. And that is why in one text by Maitreya, he clearly says that the ultimate nature of the mind is clear light, and the defilements and stains that you see are advantageous, they are temporary. And this is exactly what is being conveyed in this verse, in the Fundamental Wisdom by Nagarjuna, where it says that Buddha taught, Gautama Buddha has taught the Sauna teaching out of motivated by compassion and having dispelled the wrong views. And such as Buddha, such Shakyamuni, he appeared in the land of Arya land or India, and the three wheel of the doctor. and from the common parlance, his teachings are contained in the three Pitakas. So from that common parlance, probably there is no talk about Buddha attending the three wheel of the doctrine.
Whatever be the case, Buddha had taught vast and profound varieties of teaching. So the succeeding verses refers to the lineage holders like Maitreya, Asanga, Subhadu and so on, who are the lineage holders of the teaching of the Buddha. So therefore in the text it states, I prostrate, placing my hand at the feet of the leaders of the lineage. As I was saying, from the common parlance, we have the three Pitakas, which primarily focuses on the teaching of the seven limbs to enlightenment, which I think is the common parlance to the public. And then we have the Mahayana teachings, which are Mahayana or the Bodhisattva teachings, which primarily focuses on the practice of compassion, which focuses on not only not harming others, but helping others. And likewise the practice of Bodhicitta, and likewise the practice of the Six Perfections in relation to them. And while explaining the Six Perfections, there is a detailed explanation of the meaning of emptiness. So in terms of meaning, when Buddha taught the Four Noble Truths, and particularly while he was explaining the meaning of the true cessation, he was explaining the meaning of emptiness, and therefore we have the sections of teachings of the Buddha which is related to the wisdom perfection practice. And then in terms of the mind that meditates on the meaning of emptiness, there is a very detailed explanation of the subtlest nature of the mind in the Tantra, which is given to a selected disciples, selected few, and not given to the public. Then, I think in terms of common parlance, the Buddha path, Buddha's lineage or teachings were held by what is known as the seven lineage holders, like Nyirpi, Siddhika, Nakpo and so on. And whatever is the case, it is clear that there was a lot of degeneration took place in the Mahayana teaching. And such Mahayana teachings were then restored by Buddha's followers, like Nagarjuna and so on. So these sections of teachings of Mahayana, degenerated for some time, were restored by Nagarjuna, and Nagarjuna received such teachings from Manjushri, Maitreya and so on. And Maitreya and Manjushri, they were the close disciples of the Buddha, and in terms of the profound view, these teachings were transmitted from Manjushri to human beings like Nagarjuna, and the lineage of the vast practices from Maitreya to Asanga, and since then successive great human practitioners have happened. The vast lineage prayer here, the vast lineage here refers to the lineage that comes from the Buddha through the Maitreya.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when we talk about the lineage masters of the worst practices, this does not mean that do not practice the profound view, but the worst practices, the lineage masters of the worst practices refers to those lineage masters who primarily focus on preservation and practice of the worst lineage practices. Now, the word worst here does not refer to extensive varieties of teaching, but it primarily refers to the stages of the path, spiritual stages of the path. And the profound lineage refers to the fact that these aspects of the path are comparatively more difficult to understand comparing to the stages of the path.
yana phawa shiwa la samudra yu phungde da sha thangso me de ine ya lo lo ko le ya di chandu sha chaba da thome ne ma chi de de
de ja ko se me de yin de ja ni se ki ta ki yo ma de
ya de pha ma ya wo mo ja de ya ne lo lo ane lo lo ne da lo lo ko ta pa ni ko ma de mo de chi cha ko le ya ka sa 这种说是打了是吧切了是打了是吧这个东西打了没听你说的现在我都送的啊给啊这几个我们这些还不懂的啊大声一直把你送你稍微送了的但是你学了再多再送下去早就准备了啊但这个样子是讲的样子嘛不然太大声音我在你那时候就是什么广大我们那么东西把中文一个传起来就是来到啊这几个电影啊
And then we have the courageous conduct lineage, behavior lineage, which refers to a lineage where there is again a very special practice of development of Bodhisattva. So out of the view and the conduct, emphasis is more on the conduct of the Bodhisattva, therefore it is called the behavior or conduct lineage. And therefore on the one hand we have the lineage that comes through Maitreya, Asanga, Vasubandhu, Vedya Kokula, the lineage masters as we refer in the context of study of the Abhidhamma Alankara, ornamental realization. So that is the lineage masters of ornamental realization. And then we have the lineage masters of the Madhyamika, like Manjushri, Nagarjuna, Shantideva, Chandrakirti, and so on.
And
And the master of Tumatra, Selingba, he is the lineage of both the vast and the profound. And in the case of practices and training of Bodhisattva, Kisha, of course, received all these teachings from many masters, but he primarily received the training on the mind training from the master from Sumatra or from the Golden Isle or Golden Island. And Atisha received these teachings from Silingba or the master from Suwan Deep or Golden Island. And Atisha, I think, has many disciples in India, but his karmic connection was primarily in Tibet, and it was his prayer and his determination and to benefit the people of Tibet, and that's why he visited Tibet. They passed Tibetan Dharma teams with great hardship,
invited Adisha
to Tibet,
and the master, Yeshiva, a great Tibetan master, even sacrificed his life to invite Adisha, and out of many disciples of Adisha, the primary one is Dom Tenpa. And Dom Tenpa was a great master who has a very strong karmic connection with Adisha, and in fact Adisha and Dom Tenpa acted as teacher and student for many lives. And Dom Tenpa was an upasaka, he was not an ordained monk, but he was an upasaka, a lay practitioner, and he has countless disciples and a very well respected master. And then next is paying homage to Tsongkhapa Emanation of Manjushri, who propounded the individual spiritual parts of his great pioneers, the wisdom, lucidity, and the coherence. Very unique process of teaching of Tsongkhapa is always very lucid and clear and coherent about different aspects of the teaching. There will be certain sections of the teaching which he will quote primarily from Maitreya or from the masters from the vast masters. And then if you come on the sections on the view of emptiness, then his quotation will be primarily from Nagarjuna, Shantideva, and so on. And this does not mean to say that Vasubandhu Asanga does not speak about emptiness. They do speak about emptiness, but in terms of the explanation of the actual profound meaning of emptiness, the most reliable quotations are from the masters of the profound meaning. And therefore he would quote profusely from Nagarjuna, Shantideva, Nagarjuna, and so on. And particularly he would recite his quotations from Chandrakirti and Buddhapalika, who were the masters of the Prasangika Madhyamika. And of course on certain occasions when the text deals with the common presentation of the Sautantika Madhyamikas and Prasangika Madhyamikas, then he would cite a quotation which is attributable to both, but he would primarily cite a unique special quotation which is relevant to that particular text, and he would not just collect all the quotations which uses the word emptiness and so on. So that's the meaning of this line which says that he was a great pioneer with extreme lucidity and therefore in his own biography he clearly says that I have thoroughly studied the teachings of the six ornaments and two supremes without being satisfied by a partial and a superficial understanding. So this is really indication of a great mind who uses his wisdom and insight. So this completes paying homage. Next is next lines are making a promise to compose the text, which is I shall expound his perfect teaching with absolute accuracy. Those fortunate to follow the way of the great vehicle should pay close attention for true appreciation. So this other lines making a promise to compose the text. He is primarily saying that I will explain this text and which explains Bodhisattva. And in fact, out of this two lines, the first line is making a promise to complete the text, which gives special expound his perfection with absolute accuracy. And the next line is asking his disciples and students to listen carefully. Therefore the text reads, those fortunate to follow the way of the great miracles should pay close attention for true appreciation. So we should take this to our heart as we are listening to this text today. We should listen attentively. In my own case, I do not have much experience, but I have genuine appreciation and a strong faith and devotion, and based on that I have developed conviction and trust in these teachings. So in your case, I do not know how many days it will take, let us say around 2 weeks. So whatever you read in that text, whatever you read in the text, try to relate it to your mind, to your experience. So on the one hand, it is very important to use your intelligence and to explore it as much as possible. And having explored that, try to relate it to your heart and bring about some changes in your way of thinking and in your heart. And if you are unable to bring any change in your mind, in your heart, but simply become an expert in the intellectual scene, then you will gradually become a kind of dharma addict. And then a time will come when nobody can change you, nobody can transform you, because you have so many things to say, so many things that are in your mind, but nothing is affecting you. So therefore, whatever you study and understand, try to relate it to your emotion and try to transform them. That's the Buddhist practice.
And the
proper study and analysis is also very important, because if you are able to think about some transformation based on knowledge, reasoning, analysis, meditation and contemplation, then the transformations that you bring about is very reliable and very profound. On the other hand, if you develop some kind of faith and devotion without much contemplation, without much knowledge, then the change will not be reliable. And that's why in the Buddhist process of following the teaching, they talk about two kind of disciples. The intelligent ones, and those that they are not intelligent. In the case of the intelligent ones, they develop faith by studying the text, by reading the text, by knowing the text. And in the case of those who are not so intelligent, they follow a particular text just out of faith, without much understanding of the text. So therefore, right in the beginning, it's important to remain skeptical, to follow the Dharma with a questioning mind. And if you have questions, you will always get answers. And if you have no questions, then you will not get any answer. Without proper answer to your doubt, you will not be able to develop proper conviction. So therefore it is important to explore human intelligence, to analyze. At the same time, if you go on exploring and analyzing things without relating it to transforming your mind, then it will again be no use. Therefore in Tibetan we emphasize so much on the combination of Shidup Sungpa, which means combined practice of study and practice. Study and practice. Study and practice. And similarly, we talk about the combined practice of hearing, thinking and meditation. And so first of all, you have to hear and understand the meaning, and then on that meaning you have to repeatedly examine, analyze and contemplate, and through that way you will be able to develop certain conviction based on your own research and analysis, not simply accepting because the Lama has said. Yes, the Lama has said, but based on teaching, when you reflect, your gross and personal, then you will be able to develop some conviction. And once you are able to develop some conviction towards the meaning of the particular teaching, then you should not simply get satisfied with that kind of conviction, with that kind of knowledge that you got. But what you need to do is to get more habituated with that, to meditate on that. And it's through this way that you can bring about change in your mind. And in the Lamrim text also, it encourages us to listen to the teaching, removing all the obstructions and cultivating all the positive factors. This exceptional oral transmission of great vehicle mind training, an instruction for cultivating the precious awakening mind of Bodhisattva, will be explained in two main parts. Now here again we should understand this word, ear whisper transmission, or all transmission in this proper context. The exact translation in the Tibetan text is kind of something like ear whisper translation. So when we read this word, ear whisper translation, it should not be understood as something which is totally hidden and secret, other than from what is being taught by the Buddha. Because if the teachings of the Buddha are not the main transmission, then it will be difficult to find any transmission which we can call as secret or ear whisper transmissions. So ear whisper transmission here refers to probably process of teaching which Lama transmits to his students based on his own unique experience. So probably this means that to the public in general, he gave the general process of practice of the development of Bodhisattva, and then to some selected disciples, he particularly emphasized on the practice of the development of Bodhisattva through the practice of exchanging oneself for others. So this will be explained in two main parts, an introduction giving an historical account of the lineage of this teaching, including their unique qualities, which will encourage the intelligent to appreciate them with genuineness, and explanation of the actual teaching. Progress returning from the belonging of the Buddha can all be condensed into two intentions: to put an end to all types of mental distortions, either through the I or the misconception of self, and thereby to acquaint ourselves with an altruistic attitude through which we take responsibility for the welfare of others. The progressive planning is of the will of the doctrine refers to the turning of the will of the doctrine. The three turning of the will of the doctrine are explained in two ways. For example, the way it is categorized and explained in the Samdhi Nirmasana Sutra. And particularly in the case of the last turning of the will of the doctrine, I think there are two types within it. So all these teachings of the Buddha are meant to put an end to all types of mental distortion with regard to the I. The mental distortion with regard to the I or the misconception of self refers to self-grasping, which is of two types, grasping of the person and grasping of the phenomena. And generally when we classify the object of knowledge or phenomena, there are two types, one which is transient, another which is permanent. so therefore we categorize them as permanent phenomena or impermanent phenomena. And then the phenomena of different knowledge could also be categorized in terms of whether they are faulty or whether they are or fault, and therefore we categorize phenomena as contaminated and uncontaminated. So in the Buddhist terms, when phenomena is categorized into different classes, they are classified into different ways, as permanent, impermanent, as contaminated or uncontaminated, as samsara or as nirvana. So here when we talk about selflessness, selflessness of the person and selflessness of the phenomena, they can of course, according to some sort of thought, they can be explained in terms of their certainty. But here we are explaining the selflessness of the person and the phenomena primarily from the point of view of Nagarjuna, the Chandrakirti. So according to Chandrakirti, these two selflessnesses are explained in terms of the basis, in terms of the object, not in terms of the subtlety of the object or negation. Because both in the case of the selflessness of the person and selflessness of the phenomena, in terms of the object of negation, there is no subtlety. Both are equal in terms of subtlety. Therefore, the selflessness of the person refers to the lack of inherent existence of a person who is the experiencer, who is the enjoyer of happiness, suffering, and in fact all objects of engagement. And when we talk about selflessness of phenomena, we are talking about all those other phenomena other than the person which are being enjoyed, experienced by the person. So such distinctions are made only in terms of the basis and not in terms of the subtlety of the object of negation. His Holiness here is asking, do we have tea here? It's about 3 o'clock. Where is tea? Shall we have a short break here? Okay, we started at 1 o'clock. So I think it's better we have a short break here. So there is a self which is the enjoyer of the phenomena and the phenomena which is enjoyed by the self. So therefore here when we talk about so we wander aimlessly in the samsara or cycle of existence because of the grasping of the self. And it is by removing the grasping of the self that we get liberated from samsara, and therefore whether it's the person or the phenomena which is enjoyed by the person, they are all devoid of inherent existence, and it is through this way we can put an end to the grasping of the person and grasping of phenomena, and it's through this way we can achieve liberation. So there's one section of teaching which is primarily aimed in removing these two graspings and to come out of samsara and to achieve liberation. And then there is second intention of this teaching which is aimed towards not only achieving liberation from samsara but to achieve omniscience or Buddhahood for the sake of all sentient beings. So out of these two kinds of whether you talk about the three standing of the wheel of doctrine or the 84,000 classes of teaching taught by the Buddha, they can all be summarized into two: the teachings related to the Mahayana practice and teachings related to the lesser vehicles. So I think first of all we should have a short break, go to bathroom and come back so that you are ready for tea. You can really enjoy tea, otherwise you may not be able to enjoy the tea.